A brutal attack in Anchorage leaves an elderly couple dead and an infant assaulted. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 27th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Yukon River flooding in Galena.
Old Town, which is like right along the river, is all underwater. And just estimating from the air, it looks like several feet of water in most of the buildings or more.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A man who has been charged with killing an elderly Anchorage couple and sexually assaulting their 2-year-old great-granddaughter is a registered sex offender. On Saturday, authorities say 24-year-old Jerry Andrew Active broke into the home of 71-year-old Touch Che and his 73-year-old wife, Soren Sreep, killing them with blunt force. He was still inside the residence when their grandson and his wife arrived. The couple tried to detain him, but he fled. Anchorage police say the man was arrested Saturday night as he fled the East Anchorage homicide scene dressed only in boxer shorts and socks. Active was convicted of breaking into a home and assaulting an 11-year-old girl 4 years ago near Dillingham while her family slept. Active was also convicted of fighting members of that family. The Anchorage Daily News reported today that Active was charged with violating his probation this spring, but it's not clear what kind of correctional supervision he was under. The Yukon River is flooding in Galena as an ice jam at a notorious bend called Bishop's Rock is keeping water high. Ed Plum is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service. He's in Galena and says the water started coming up rapidly this afternoon.
Old Town, which is like right along the river, is all underwater. And just estimating from the air, it looks like several feet of water in most of the buildings or more. And then the sections of Newtown or Uptown, just upriver, there's a lot of sections of town that are cut off because roads are washed out. And a lot of, just from the air, we could see a lot of buildings, homes, and residences underwater or with water in them.
Plum says the power is off in Galena, but it was not clear if city officials had shut it off or if it had blown out. He says the Yukon is low farther downriver from the jam at Bishop's Rock.
Ice is starting to kind of shift and move from Kayakuk down to Nulato. And we have reports that even down to Caltech, some of the ice is shifting. So that could be a good thing for those communities when this ice jam does break, if the ice downriver has shifted and moved some.
National Weather Service hydrologist David Struble says farther to the northwest, there is a flood warning for Hughes on the Kayakuk River.
Where the ice jammed up this morning at 3 a.m., they subsequently had some minor flooding during the morning hours, and as of around noon, the water was dropping a little bit at Hughes. Also, the village of Buckland on the Buckland River has an ice jam where minor flooding is occurring, and that ice could cause more problems for Buckland over the next 2 days, as it's usually a slower process for the ice to go out.
Struble says the rapid warming conditions could create flooding concerns for other parts of the state this week, including South Central Alaska. The Coast Guard probe of the grounding of the drilling rig Kulik resumes tomorrow after running through last Saturday with questioning of a Shell executive who explained the lines of authority during multiple overlapping vacations in their Alaska office at the same time that a tax deadline was approaching and a critical marine operation was beginning. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Shell Alaska operations head Sean Churchfield faced hours of close questioning on the decision to start towing the large saucer-shaped drilling rig to Seattle on December 21st, just as Vice President Pete Slaby was going on vacation. as others have. Churchfield cited the weather window, but he also admitted that the, quote, potential tax liability of going into another year in Dutch Harbor was an important factor in the late December departure. The shipyard in Seattle wasn't available until February, and the rig would have had to mark time at a berth in Everett in the meantime. Churchfield was then questioned about the company's policy on allowing its executives to go on leave when high-risk and high-visibility operations are scheduled. Churchfield left his deputy, Buddy Custard, in charge for the tow, but it also turns out that at the same time that he was on leave, Churchfield was filling in for vacationing Shell Alaska Vice President Pete Slaby. Did that mean, asked Susan Dwornick of the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, that Custard was running everything?
The Vice President delegated his authorities to me, and I delegated my authorities to Buddy Custard. So the Vice President's delegation did not bypass me down to Buddy Custard. In Pete Slaby's absence, I had the decision authority of the Vice President during my vacation.
This still in effect while you were on holiday?
That's correct.
Churchfield said it was agreed that he would stay in the state while Slaby was gone and be available, checking in by email. He also noted that Custard, a retired Alaska Coast Guard officer, was highly capable. Investigators also tried to get to the bottom of something that happened aboard the Kulik when the Coast Guard was trying to use helicopters to evacuate the 18 crew members after the engines of the tug Ivic failed, and another tug, the Guardian, owned by Crowley Marine, had been attached to the Ivic and was trying, with no success, to haul adrift toward the shallows. Earlier, Todd Case, the manager aboard the Kulik, testified that the survival anchor was accidentally dropped at that time and that Crowley had threatened to cut the tow if that happened. Churchfield's notes contain some references to that. Case testified that the anchor deployment was due to what he called miscommunication. Churchfield was asked to explain his notes, but said there were a number of things he wasn't sure of. Here is part of an exchange between him and Crowley attorney Matthew Vafidis.
It says, survival anchor deployed, dragging but not caught, anchor is on the stern.
Right. And at the bottom there, what does that say?
It says Ivic and guardsmen still attached.
Okay. Let me ask if you recollect being told at the time that personnel aboard the Kulik were proposing to drop the survival anchor in order to spin the rig so that the helicopter pad was out of the weather and the personnel could be evacuated from that pad. Do you recall that?
No, I don't have that recollection, no.
A few days before, Todd Case had also been questioned about this by Commander Josh McTaggart, head of the investigating team.
Were there discussions at the time with respect to rotating the Kulik?
Yeah.
Could you go into that?
Well, we discussed using the survival anchor if we could drop it and possibly get the rig to rotate. And that would have put the wind blowing in a direction we could have got the helicopter in, but it was only a discussion at that time.
Okay. So what occurred after that?
Well, after the Coast Guard said that we could not go in, during the discussion of using the emergency anchor, I had sent the barge engineer and ballast control operator down to stand by the winch, and it got accidentally dropped sometime in the middle of all this.
Case said at that point the survival anchor was only down a brief time and then pulled up again. Later on, when the tow from the Guardian did part, all parties agreed to deploy the anchor, but it never caught. Case said it just dragged along the bottom. But it began to get light after that, and the Coast Guard helicopters made another attempt and were able to get the crew off. Efforts by several tugs to stop the rig's drift or at least steer it continued, but ultimately it hit the rocks and grounded on Sikkelitik Island. Sean Churchfield was asked the same question investigators have put to others if, knowing what he knows now, there are things that he would have done differently.
Without being a mariner, I'm not really able to comment on the technical details of the tow specifically, but the one observation I would make is that we will be looking very hard at how we conducted the operation to see what lessons we can learn from them and ensure those lessons are carried forward into future plans and future towing operations.
In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new account of the first ascent of Denali.
Harry pointed and says, I'll even put in a camp up there, and pointed to the pass between the two peaks, if I have to get you there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
100 years ago today, the first expedition to summit Denali was slowly making its way up the mountain. After setting out from Fairbanks in mid-March, the four-man team finally topped out on North America's tallest peak on June 7, 1913. It's often called the Stuck Expedition, after Hudson Stuck, the man who organized it. But a new book tells the story of the man who led the expedition to the top. Harry Carstens was a determined sled dog mail carrier with no previous climbing experience. Tom Walker is the author of the book called The 70-Mile Kid, The Lost Legacy of Harry Carstens and the First Ascent of Mount McKinley. He relies on a previously undiscovered diary of one of the expedition members and an important missing section of Hudson Stuck's journal to reveal a new version of the historic climb. Walker says Hudson Stuck badgered Carstens to climb Denali with him until he finally agreed to the 1913 expedition.
And they were to go as equal partners, and they were to share in everything. And right away, when they got on the glacier, it became very apparent to Carstens that Stuck, for some reason, did not have the experience he claimed to have at climbing. Stuck had always hired guides. And once they got on the Muldrow, it was very apparent that A, he didn't have the ability, and B, he was actually quite frail. So when they started out, he couldn't do a lot of the work. So the work shifted from equal partners to Carstens being a guide. And this infuriated him. And one day when they went out to advance their trail and they had to turn around because Stuck started to falter, when they got back to camp, Harry pointed and says, I'll even put in a camp up there, and pointed to the pass between the two peaks, the north and south peak of Denali, if I have to get you there.
Well, let's talk about Robert Tatum a bit. The journal of expedition member Robert Tatum turned out to be the missing link. How did you find the journal and what did it reveal?
I have to give a lot of credit to Ken Carstens, who is Harry Carstens' great-grandson. And he is a stay-at-home dad in Colorado. And he's on the internet all of the time. And I'd searched for years and years to find Tatum's journal. I knew there was one, but I could never find it. I tried the Episcopal Church archives in Austin, Texas. And finally, Ken, doing research, found one brief, tiny reference to the Robert Tatum papers at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville. And his father, Gene, flew to Knoxville to look in those papers and see what was there, and he physically found the journal. And it had never been accessed since the time it had been donated to the University of Tennessee. So he got me a copy. I read it, and it was as detailed as Stuck's, but it revealed a whole nother side of the expedition that no one was aware of. The controversy afterwards was that Stuck and Carstens never got along and never spoke after the climb. And Tatum's revealed many of the reasons why, as he saw it. And as you read it, you went, oh my gosh, the real leader of this expedition was Harry Carstens. He and Walter Harper were the powerhouses behind the four climbers. They were the engine that drove this climb. And Stuck and Tatum were like tourists would be that had hired guides to go to the summit.
What was it like to read when you finally got a copy of Tatum's journal? How did that fit?
This just fit one more piece of the puzzle. My real contribution to the history of the whole thing was actually finding part of Stuck's missing diary. When he'd climbed the mountain, he kept this voluminous journal. It's probably a composition-style notebook in flawless handwriting that's very readable with all of the observations. But always what was missing was the one or two weeks around the actual summit climb itself. Once they'd topped Karsten's Ridge and they did the week of the actual attack on the summit, that had always been missing. And through a lot of diligent research and the help of an archivist in Milwaukee, I finally made contact with Peter Lewis, who had been the former director of the American Geographical Society. And he looked for it and found it for me in Brooklyn, New York. And it was in such poor condition, he wouldn't copy it. He photographed it and sent me the digital photographs. So I was the first person to have the complete Stuck remembrances of the climb. And when you put all four of them together, it gave you a whole new impression of what had happened.
What about Walter Harper? He was Alaska Native, and he was actually the first to summit. What was his role?
The order in summiting was Harper, followed by Karstens, followed by Tatum, followed at the end of the rope by Hudson Stuck, who was carrying absolutely nothing in his pack. Everybody had taken his load because he was so physically at his limit. He collapsed on the summit unconscious until he got his wind back. And he'd known for quite a while that he was nearing the end of his rope, so to speak. And the reason that Harper was in the lead was because he had cooked the night before, and his cooking left a little bit to be desired, and he had basically poisoned everybody but himself. As Stuck said in his journal, Walter has a cast iron stomach and nothing affects him.
As you know, Denali is an Athabascan word. Did it seem somehow appropriate that Walter Harper should be the first person to summit?
Well, I think it is. A lot of people think it was a grand scheme to send the native person first, you know, to make some statement, but it wasn't at all. But in retrospect, it was. There's a lot of native names for the summit, but he should have been first. So honoring the native people, I think it was a grand gesture.
Tom Walker's book, The 70-Mile Kid, tells the lost history of the first summit of Denali. June 7th is the 100-year anniversary of their successful climb. The University of Alaska Fairbanks says tuition and research funding are unlikely to increase enough in the coming year to offset rising costs. In a memo, Vice Chancellor Pat Pitney says UAF will face significant budget issues in fiscal year 2014, starting July 1st. Pitney says those issues are manageable through increasing non-state revenue and decreasing spending. UAF's leadership is also soliciting ideas from faculty and staff who are invited to submit suggestions to an online suggestion box.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in good health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
It seems there is one more casualty in the media wars. Anchorage's old-time music station KHAR went through an abrupt and unannounced program format change early this month, much to the chagrin of its loyal listeners. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the incident only serves to highlight the realities of a rapidly changing industry and the challenges posed by tough economic times.
Fill my heart with song and let me sing.
Some Anchorage area radio listeners were shocked earlier this month when an easy listening music station abruptly changed its format without warning. Some KHAR listeners went to bed to the romantic strains of Frank Sinatra.
In other words,
and woke to sports jocks' high decibel early morning rants. And now fans of the old music format are vetting their frustration through letters, many, many letters, to the Anchorage Daily News.
That's the way that they are making themselves heard, is to write in those letters to the editor. That is the reason that you're seeing them, such a proliferation in the print media of the complaint letters.
KHAR program director Joe Campbell made the decision to change. Campbell admits that the station's operators did not give its listeners a heads up for several reasons, but mainly not to warn the competition.
So we don't want to kind of give them a clue as to what we were doing. And the ink wasn't dry on the contract to secure CBS Sports Radio until just a couple of days before you heard it come on May 1st. You also don't want to have your advertisers taken by surprise.
A flood of letters to the editor of the Anchorage Daily News tells a different story. For 3 weeks now, the newspaper has printed at least one, and sometimes up to four a day, from KHAR listeners protesting the change. Campbell says the letters only prove his point. A handful of older listeners are complaining, not the younger demographic that KHAR's owners want to attract.
The folks emailing into us, the phone calls that we would normally get in making any kind of a change on one of these stations, would garner hundreds of people calling into the station immediately to complain. And you kind of see it in a much more immediate fashion than just folks who have written in a letter to the editor. And I frankly kind of question why they're continuing to print so many of them. Makes me wonder that there's nothing else going on in town.
But Frank Gurjevic, opinion page editor for the Anchorage Daily News, says the letters reflect what the community is interested in.
Well, we're not trying to get at anybody. I mean, this is just a matter of running the letters that we get. We had more letters about KHAR than any other subject. This isn't a matter of our deciding to choose a subject. This is a matter of what we're getting, what people are writing into us.
In the past week alone, the Anchorage Daily News has printed 12 letters protesting the change. Gurjevic says they just keep coming.
Well, we haven't printed them all. I've probably printed most of them. I don't have a count. But what we have had is just a steady stream of letters since the change in format.
Campbell fires back that if the number of letters printed was multiplied by 100, the number would not represent enough people to keep a radio station on air. Campbell compliments fans of KHAR's old format for the time spent listening, an important indicator of a station's health. But he says there just isn't enough of them to notch up the station's Arbitron ratings. He defends the move and says it won't be reversed. Under the old format, the advertising was not only just not there. What advertising there was aimed at a specific audience.
A lot of the local advertising that you hear on other radio stations had started to disappear off of KHAR, and we were starting to get down to two very specific product lines. We were advertising for funeral homes and crematories were the advertising dollars that we were able to attract to the radio station.
Frank Gurjevic says, in a way, KHAR and the Anchorage Daily News have a lot in common.
The newspapers have been struggling, and KHAR easy listening format listeners were probably older Alaskans for the most part, and it's older Alaskans who, you know, remain loyal newspaper readers.
I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska has one of the most vibrant beer scenes in the country. Despite its small population, it has more breweries than denser populated states like Connecticut, Maryland, South Carolina, and Kentucky. Every year, most of Alaska's breweries descend on tiny Haines for their annual Brew Fest. This year, they celebrated their 21st birthday and had their highest turnout yet. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez has this audio postcard.
Can I have the Pilsner, please? I'm Jessica Edwards, and
what do you do here?
I'm the incoming executive director of the Southeast Alaska State Fair. We put on the beer festival. It's a little bit of a party, but it's also just that there's just a friendly feeling to it, and I think that's part of the culture of the festival. It's probably about 1,500 people in the gates right now. We're a town of 2,500 people, so that's a lot of people at one festival in our town at one time. And this is an outdoor festival. It's held in the movie set from White Fang that was produced here in Haines, and so it's got this sort of Old West feel and a real festival atmosphere. It's very fun. The popularity of craft beer is just kind of booming nationwide. So the attitude that people have about being self-reliant, you know, like with subsistence gathering and making your own stuff, it's part of our culture here, I think.
It's a sing-along if you sing very, very quietly and not near me.
My name's Rob Miller. I am the organizer of the homebrew competition. A lot of people joke about, oh yeah, tough duty tasting beer, but I don't think they realize this year we had nearly 50% more entries than last year. We had 113 beers entered. We had two or three gushers, and a gusher is when you open the cap and it kind of half explodes and makes a mess. It's either been over carbonated or it has some sort of bacterial infection which makes it livelier than it ought to be, and that's always interesting. It's not a selling point for your beer in the contest.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.